Welcome to this new detailed edition of the BayPay Forum Blockchain News. My name is Cindy and today is April 27, 2020. This edition is brought to you by PayCademy, the first business academy to learn payments and fintech. If you have some news in payments and fintech, send it to us at press@baypayforum.com and we will do our best to include your news. In this edition, we will talk about U.S. regulator clears security token trading system to launch. Crypto exchange offers credit lines so institutions can trade now, pay later. Bitcoin hits highest level since Black Thursday amid halving buzz. The Netherlands AMLD 5 interpretation appears to be killing crypto firms. First mover, Ether trounces Bitcoin as network sees surge in stablecoins. Crypto long and short, how oil going negative could open the door for Bitcoin ETFs. Now let's get started. U.S. regulator clears security token trading system to launch. The Public-Private Execution Network, PPEX, an alternative trading system, ATS, for exempted digital assets and other private securities, has regulatory clearance to launch in the U.S. The trading system's parent, broker-dealer North Capital Private Securities, completed FINRA's continuing membership application in February and received SEC approval on its Form ATS filing in March, said North Capital CEO Jim Dowd. Those green lights were all his Salt Lake City firm needed, but it sat on the news until this past Thursday. Now, the company plans to launch with digital asset trading capabilities hardwired into its ATS. Dowd said that's a notable difference from many other approved exempted digital asset ATSs, which he said were retooled to handle digital securities only after they were already built. "We basically went the other way and said, okay, we're going to do something de novo," Dowd said. PPEX will enter the capital markets with a wide but specialized net. By Dowd's telling, PPEX supports secondary trades for all manner of exempt securities, including digital assets native to a blockchain. These private equity products aren't subject to the same disclosure and registration requirements as their publicly traded products who have to register with the SEC. Exemption appeals to issuers who don't want to go through the brain damage and the cost of doing a registered offering, said Dowd, but it comes with a caveat, too. Private capital markets are generally more illiquid than public ones, and their lack of transparency makes it difficult for potential investors to know what they're getting into. PPEX will attempt to address both, Dowd said. "We're going to offer a solution that's kind of in between a fully private illiquid non-created asset and a kind of a traditional public offering," Dowd said. His plan will institute due diligence procedures, disclosure requirements and other processes comparable to the public listing process. Dowd said PPEX also addresses the technological deficiencies rampant in private capital markets, where the systems that securities trade on, if they trade on systems at all, are often far behind the times. "That's especially evident in the age of COVID-19, he said. "I believe now more than ever that pushing paper and having meetings and signing things in person and doing all these things that we do with private securities could definitely be improved with blockchain," Dowd said. North Capital's crypto ventures began shortly after the July 2017 Dow report release. It was still the go-go blockchain days, as Dowd said of the time more often referred to as the ICO boom, but in spite of what he called the mania of the period in a 2019 letter to the SEC, Dowd saw an opening. "The explosive growth of the market nevertheless showed that investors want to trade private securities," Dowd wrote to the SEC. "It offers a means by which responsible, regulated broker-dealers and ATS can develop market protocols and systems for trading private securities on secondary markets." North Capital previously released the precursor issuance tool in Transact API, which lets broker-dealers conduct online offerings of private digital assets and other exempted securities that PPEX, which is a secondary trading system, can now facilitate trades of. Dowd said Transact API has been involved in 1,000 deals worth a total $1.9 billion. Though digital assets are only part of Transact API and PPEX's wider private securities trading capabilities, they do represent perhaps the most transformative point, from a technological aspect at least, Dowd said. The digital asset technology of blockchain technology really could offer a way to automate and to make more efficient some of the inefficiencies in private markets, and that's what got us excited about technology 3 years ago, he said. Crypto exchange offers credit lines so institutions can trade now, pay later. LGO Markets is taking an unusual step for a cryptocurrency exchange by letting clients trade without pre-funding accounts. The Hoboken, NJ-based firm's clients, mostly crypto hedge funds and market makers, can now get an intraday credit line and send cash to the exchange when the trading day is over, CEO Hugo Renaudin told CoinDesk. For LGO, which now boasts over 50 clients, almost all of them institutions, in about 20 countries, the nominal end of the day is 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Renaudin said. After passing a risk assessment, a client can get up to several millions of dollars in credit to trade Bitcoin and then pay what it owes at the settlement time, he said. They don't have to park funds, there is no risk of a hack, it's a scalable and flexible way to finance. We can extend these credit lines, and it works as a clearinghouse. Although it's commonplace in traditional financial markets, allowing trades without pre-funding is rare in crypto. According to Matt Trudeau, Chief Product and Strategy Officer at ArisX, LGO's competitor, pre-funding is necessary to mitigate counterparty risk. Because both cash and crypto are already in the clearinghouse, we eliminate settlement risk for the counterparties. This also means all participants on our exchange can confidently trade with all other participants on our exchange without needing to know who they are, and assess their credit risks, Trudeau explained. To finance this service, LGO is using a combination of funds it raised in its 2018 token sale, which brought in 3,600 BTC, nearly $36 million at the time, and borrowed capital, both in fiat and crypto, from traditional banks and crypto lenders, Renaudin said. He wouldn't identify the lenders. LGO is banking at the crypto-friendly Signature Bank and recently got financing from the market maker B2C2, which bought a share in the exchange this month. Course correction. The credit line is not the first unorthodox idea LGO has tried. When it launched in March 2019, Renaudin told CoinDesk that LGO wouldn't keep clients' funds. The plan was that users would maintain their own custody and trade via multi-signature wallets that required 2 out of 3 private keys to release funds. A year later, LGO quietly abandoned the idea. The reason? Institutional clients, who are the exchange's target audience, don't want to take care of their keys, Renaudin said last week. Most of the volume is made by crypto-native institutions, like hedge funds, and they are used to using custodial platforms, Renaudin explained. Having funds with a qualified custodian helps the institutional players sleep at night, he said, so LGO's clients can hold their funds either on the exchange itself or use BitGo, which partnered with LGO in April 2019. Another idea, making its own hardware wallet, which LGO was planning to release sometime in the summer of 2019, also got scrapped, Renaudin said. For the same reason, no client demand. All the bells and whistles we talked about last year, they were good, but when confronted with the market, we saw the demand was not there, Renaudin said. LGO has also decided not to pursue a number of licenses as originally intended. These include a New York BIT license, a FINRA broker-dealer license and a National Futures Association broker license. All this is on hold now, Renaudin said. LGO decided to focus on the more familiar jurisdiction of France, where Renaudin and other members of the team hail from. The exchange has applied for a digital custodial license there, Renaudin said. LGO is registered as a money services business (MSB) in the U.S. with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network (FinCEN), a bureau of the Treasury Department. However, one idea from the early days survived, broadcasting LGO's trades, both the fiat and crypto sides, to the Bitcoin blockchain. A list of these trades can be seen on the LGO website. According to this page, LGO has processed some $33 million worth of trades so far in April, $138 million in March and $96 million in February. Bitcoin hits highest level since Black Thursday amid halving buzz. Bitcoin's rally is gathering pace with the mining reward halving now just 14 days away. The top cryptocurrency by market value rose to $7,800 early on Monday to hit its highest level since March 12, dubbed Black Thursday, when prices fell from $7,950 to $4,700 as the coronavirus pandemic crashed most markets. At press time, Bitcoin is changing hands near $7,700, representing a 100% gain on the low of $3,867 registered on March 13. While the major part of the recovery rally could be associated with the uptick in the S&P 500 and the global stock markets, the recent move from the April 21 low of $6,800 to $7,800 looks to have been fueled by factors other than moves in equities. That's evident from the fact that Bitcoin rose 8% last week, while the S&P 500 suffered a 1.3% loss and oil markets cratered on oversupply concerns. Bitcoin looks to have partly decoupled from the equity markets due to the bullish narrative surrounding the upcoming halving. The rally is being sustained by the rapidly approaching halving. Jahan Chu, co-founder and managing partner at Hong Kong-based blockchain investment and trading firm Kinetti Capital, told CoinDesk. Bitcoin will undergo the halving process on May 12, after which the reward per block mined will drop to 6.25 BTC from the current 12.50 BTC. A popular narrative is that halving creates a supply deficit and, thus, bodes well for Bitcoin's price. Some observers are of the opinion that the bull markets seen in 2017 and 2013 were the result of the halvings in 2016 and 2012, respectively. Look for prices to attempt the $10,000 level on speculative buzz leading into the halving, Chu added. Meanwhile, Marcus Swanepoel, CEO of cryptocurrency platform Luno, said, "History tells us that we should expect an uplift in Bitcoin's price as we get closer to the halving in just a few weeks' time. We've seen an increase in the price of Bitcoin in previous halvings. Past data shows the cryptocurrency tends to hit a new market cycle top, the highest point from the preceding bear market low, in the calendar year of a halving but before the event," according to analyst Rekt Capital. "If the historical pattern repeats, we could see a rise to levels above $13,880 2019 high before the third halving, due in 2 weeks. While that target looks far-fetched, a convincing break above $8,000 cannot be ruled out, as on-chain data shows a significant improvement in network activity. For example, the 7-day average of the number of active Bitcoin entities recently rose above 260,000 for the first time since June 2019, signaling an influx of new investors into the market, according to blockchain intelligence firm Glassnode. The active entities metric counts clusters of Bitcoin addresses controlled by the same network entity. It shows the number of individuals or businesses using the network, in effect. Further, Bitcoin balances on exchanges continue to drop ahead of reward halving, a sign users are withdrawing their assets for longer-term holding. The metric appears to reflect bullish expectations tied to the halving. What's more, institutions and macro traders are returning to the crypto markets after last month's crash, as suggested by the rise in open interest, or open positions, in Bitcoin futures listed on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, CME, widely considered to be synonymous with institutional activity. Open interest rose to 233 million last Thursday to hit the highest level since February 26, according to crypto derivatives research firm Skew. However, while on-chain activity and derivatives data suggest scope for further gains, the equity markets are calling for caution. As of Friday, the S&P 500 was up nearly 30% from the low of 2,192 reached on March 24 and down 17% from record highs. While the recovery rally looks impressive on the surface, the breadth of the move has been quite narrow, meaning the rally has been fueled by an uptick in few heavyweight stocks. The S&P 500 now trades just 17% below its all-time high, however, the median S&P 500 constituent trades 28% below its record high, said Goldman Sachs chief equity strategist David Kostin. Such rallies are often short-lived. If equities begin falling again, cash may again become a safe haven. In that case, Bitcoin may come under pressure, too. The Netherlands AMLD5 interpretation appears to be killing crypto firms. The Dutch crypto market is seeing the first of most likely many small crypto exchanges get squeezed out following the passage of heavily criticized anti-money laundering AMLD5 regulations. Announced Friday in a company blog, Bitter founder Ruben Waterman said his Bitcoin exchange, launched in 2018, will shut down by April 28 as the one-man operation does not have the capital to meet the new regulations. The Dutch National Bank, DNB, estimates that registration alone costs $36,500, in addition to rolling compliance needs. The development shows what Dutch regulators expect of financial upstarts and could speak to future hurdles to cryptocurrency development in the greater European Union. Above all, Bitter would have to appoint a dedicated compliance officer who's responsible for compliance with the new regulations, Ruben wrote Friday. Who can I appoint? Myself? That probably doesn't work, also being the sole shareholder and director. Under Dutch law, businesses pay for their own regulations out of pocket. Ruben said the options for his Bitcoin savings platform included keeping a lawyer on retainer, paying a compliance officer, or finding a third party to manage compliance costs in addition to the government registration fee. Impossible, he said, given the firm's small size. Making sense of it all. As CoinDesk reported in December, Dutch cryptocurrency firms were entangled in a protracted battle of semantics with the DNB and Ministry of Finance (FIN) over the implementation of the European Union's fifth anti-money laundering directive AMLD5, which went into effect in January 2020. Bitcoin firms CoinDesk spoke with said the DNB and FIN were strengthening the EU directive needlessly while using doublespeak with the Dutch parliament. The firms alleged the financial regulators had created a de facto licensing regime, whereas AMLD5 calls for mere registration of cryptocurrency firms. These allegations were further supported by the Dutch Council of State, a governmental advisory board widely respected in the country, which asked the finance agencies to clarify their proposals. Members of the Dutch parliament held two competing priorities in mind: fighting money laundering and supporting the nation's fintech firms. In a parliamentary report from April 21, Dutch Senator Bastiaan van Apeldoorn said it's unlikely cryptocurrencies are being used on the same scale as cash for money laundering, but they still require supervision. Finding a soft regulatory touch that wouldn't displace small players in the market remained the goal, he said. The cryptocurrency phenomenon does exist and is likely to take on even larger, if not different, forms in the future. It is therefore good that this is also adequately regulated with regard to money laundering, van Apeldoorn said. Editors note, this report was translated. The legislation was tied up on the point for months, even though the EU called for the directive to go into effect on January 10. Legislation was finally adopted last Tuesday, although opinions on its outcome differ. Wrote Bitter's Ruben. The Minister of Finance, Wopke Hoekstra, then changed some wording so as to comply with the Council of State's request but not actually changed any of its content. The Senate has raised questions about this practice but nevertheless approved the new regulations. The registration process was still a licensing regime, verbiage aside, Ruben argued. If it looks like a duck, swims like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it probably is a duck, he wrote. Other players. In a blog post last Wednesday, Bitonic, a Dutch exchange led by Don Kleiman, who also heads a crypto lobbying group VBNL, said the final legislation resolved the two main issues of concern for Bitonic. The firm said the DNB and FIN had clarified the difference between licensing and registration plus the associated regulatory costs. We will closely monitor this when the law has entered into force, but it appears that for now, the threat of an excessive and costly supervisory regime is off the table, Bitonic wrote. Some firms haven't waited to see what the DNB and FIN would concoct, however. Industry-leading crypto derivatives exchange Deribit left the country for Panama in February, citing uncertainties around the incoming regulation. We believe that crypto markets should be freely available to most, and the new regulations would put too high barriers for the majority of traders, both regulatory and cost-wise, Deribit wrote in a January blog post announcing the move. Arthur Stolk, managing director of Dutch cryptocurrency fund Iconic, told CoinDesk in an interview that most firms had anticipated the passage and are going to wait it out until a promised evaluation by FIN takes place. His largest concern for smaller firms is with the flat regulatory fee every market participant now has to pay for oversight, as compared to a per-volume cost applied in most cases. The problem is that in normal traditional finance, if you are regulated and you have a license, you need to pay by your volume. So, it's a fair deal. Now everyone pays the same. In 1 year they do the evaluation, please do it by volume because then all the small projects can stay, Stolk said. And, unlike other governments, the Netherlands isn't behind the times on crypto. In fact, it's trying to lead the charge in the EU for issuing a central bank digital currency, CBDC, according to a recent DNB report. If the decision should be taken within the euro system to experiment with a more concrete type of CBDC, we are ready to play a leading role, the DNB wrote in its 45-page report published last week. The Netherlands provides a suitable testing ground for such an experiment. First mover, Ether trounces Bitcoin as network sees surge in stablecoins. Ether's price might be getting a boost from the crypto industry's version of the Dash for Cash. The coronavirus crisis has sent investors in both digital and traditional markets scrambling for US dollars, seen as one of the best assets to park money in during a deflationary recession. In traditional markets, that's meant selling risky assets like stocks, junk bonds and developing country currencies, and parking the proceeds in cash. You're reading First Mover, CoinDesk's daily markets newsletter. Assembled by the CoinDesk Markets team, First Mover starts your day with the most up-to-date sentiment around crypto markets, which of course never close, putting in context every wild swing in Bitcoin and more. We follow the money so you don't have to. You can subscribe here. In digital asset markets, there's been a flurry of demand for Tether and other dollar-linked stablecoins, many of them built atop the Ethereum blockchain network. Led by Tether, USDT, the total outstanding amount of stablecoins surged this month to nearly $9 billion, from less than $6 billion in early March. Some cryptocurrency analysts are now starting to ask if the stablecoin surge will boost the price of Ether, ETH, which is used to pay fees known as gas to help process transactions on the Ethereum blockchain, including for other tokens. Prices for Ether, the second biggest cryptocurrency by market value, have jumped 53% so far in 2020 to about $195. That compares with an 8% year-to-date gain for the larger Bitcoin. Ryan Watkins, a research analyst at the cryptocurrency data firm Messari, wrote last week in a report that Tether's use of the Ethereum blockchain should be positive for ETH. It's hard to ignore the promise of decentralized programmable money if you're spending time in the Ethereum economy, he wrote. This will provide a bid for ETH. Ether, sometimes described as the digital oil to Bitcoin's digital gold, is the naive currency for the Ethereum blockchain, which is known as a platform for easy issuance of new digital tokens as well as for its smart contract programming capabilities. In recent years, Ethereum has become the premier ecosystem for the white-hot arena of decentralized finance, where startup companies and developer teams are designing automated lending and trading protocols that might eventually challenge banks. Yet, Ether is notoriously difficult to value, with traders relying on everything from price chart patterns to supply and demand predictions to discounted cash flow analysis. Earlier this year, one blockchain consultant estimated that the cryptocurrency's price might shoot as high as $10,000 if half of Argentina's money supply abandoned the peso for DAI, a decentralized dollar-linked stablecoin that's backed by Ether. I don't think we're at a point where fundamentals are driving these tokens, says Gary Zsigmond, co-founder of Digico Capital, a cryptocurrency hedge fund. We're still at the story stage, where everything's in the future. Messari's Watkins says the rise of stablecoins might actually pose a longer-term threat to Ether because they might usurp its potential use case as a medium of exchange. In this scenario, ETH will have devolved into its native early branding of digital oil, a commodity-like lubricant for the Ethereum blockchain, he wrote. ETH would still be valuable like many commodities are, but ETH would not be valued like money is. But with the price performance beating Bitcoin so handily this year, Ether bulls probably aren't worrying too much about the valuation metrics. Trend: Bitcoin has nearly erased the losses seen on March 12 Black Thursday with a move to $7,800 early Monday, and now looks set to extend its 5-week winning trend. The top cryptocurrency by market value is trading near $7,714 at press time, representing a 0.2% gain on the day. Prices rose more than 8% in the 7 days to April 26 to confirm Bitcoin's sixth straight weekly rise, the longest winning streak since March 2019. The price rise could be extended further, as Bitcoin balances on exchanges continues to slide ahead of the miner reward having a sign investors are withdrawing their assets for long-term holding ahead of the supply cutting event, as noted by the blockchain intelligence firm Glassnode. Bitcoin has historically put in a positive performance in the weeks leading up to halving, Marcus Swanepoel, CEO of cryptocurrency platform Luno, told CoinDesk. The bullish narrative surrounding the halving could continue to draw bids for the cryptocurrency in the short term. Further, speculation that savvy investors might use recently minted Tether and other stablecoins to fund Bitcoin purchases is likely to keep retail interest high. Traders will want to pay close attention to the issuing of new USDT, which has historically led to a surge in Bitcoin's price. With Tether having minted $120 million USDT, Bitcoin could soon see a surge, said Swanepoel. Technical charts, too, are signaling scope for an extension on the price rally. The 4-hour chart is reporting a symmetrical triangle breakout, a bullish continuation pattern. The breakout is backed by an above 50 reading on the 14-day relative strength index and higher bars on the MACD histogram, both bullish signals. Next, the cryptocurrency looks set to test the 100-day moving average at $8,000. The bullish case would weaken if the prices violate the support at $7,390, low of the symmetrical triangle. Crypto long and short, how oil going negative could open the door for Bitcoin ETFs. This will always be remembered as the week when oil went negative. The economic repercussions of this are staggering and will take months to fully comprehend, but, more short-term, one of the most fascinating aspects is how it knocks universally accepted truths about markets right into the oil can. Also compelling is what this says about biases in the Bitcoin market. You're reading Crypto Long and Short, a newsletter that looks closely at the forces driving cryptocurrency markets. Authored by CoinDesk's head of research, Noel Acheson, it goes out every Sunday and offers a recap of the week with insights and analysis from a professional investor's point of view. You can subscribe here. It turns out commodity prices don't have a floor. Who knew? To be fair, this is not the first time a commodity has traded below zero. Natural gas prices have gone negative in the past as logistical problems make it hard to get to buyers, and many refineries see it as a waste byproduct of oil production. Outside the energy sector, dairy farmers across the U.S. are currently dumping excess milk rather than pay consumers to take it away. What does this have to do with Bitcoin? It sheds light on the nature of the asset itself, and on products built on top of it. According to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, and other regulators, Bitcoin is a commodity. Technically, it falls into the category of financial commodities, which include currencies and indices. These do have a floor. They can go to zero, but not below once at the minimum. They have neither a use nor a carry cost, so investors can write off their value and, after some gnashing of teeth, forget about them. But what if a financial commodity's value was based on an underlying commodity that traded at negative prices? USO is the largest exchange-traded fund ETF in the energy sector and holds near-dated WTI futures. This week those futures were trading below zero, since they involve physical delivery of oil that no one knows where to store. But the ETF is a financial commodity, and cannot trade below zero, therefore, it cannot reflect its underlying assets. This week, USO scrambled to save its listing. It announced a reverse share split to push its price back above the NASDAQ minimum requirement, and it changed its investment strategy to focus on slightly longer-term futures. It also applied for authorization to issue more shares, since money is pouring in, reportedly from retail investors who hope to ride the recovery all the way up. So, here you have an ETF whose value does not necessarily reflect the underlying asset, maneuvering to be able to sell more shares to retail investors in a dislocated market that is one of the most blatantly manipulated in the world. And yet, Bitcoin ETF proposals are rejected as being too risky, opaque, and manipulable. A Bitcoin ETF would be based on a financial commodity that runs on a global network accessible to all. Most of the main exchanges have market surveillance, and improvements in market liquidity should enable the ETF price to closely track the market value of the underlying asset, giving investors reassuring clarity and transparency. The same cannot be said of the most liquid listed Bitcoin tracking instruments today, which have lock-in periods during which investors cannot sell and which trade at a significant premium to Bitcoin. This is largely a result of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's reluctance to approve liquid and easily redeemable investment vehicles suitable for all types of investors. Any change in SEC policy regarding Bitcoin ETFs is unlikely in the short term because there are no current proposals under consideration. But the disconnect between the reasons given for rejection and the glaringly public characteristics of many approved ETFs that also don't meet the quoted criteria could encourage the regulator to overcome its instinctive reluctance. One of these is GBTC, managed by Grayscale Investments, which is owned by CoinDesk's parent, DCG. Anyone know what's going on yet? There is no such thing as a boring week in the crypto asset sector. Unfortunately, a boring week would be nice every now and then, but this week was particularly intense, with the price ranging 12% from low to high, data from the CoinDesk BPI. According to my colleague Zach Vole, the sharp jump upwards may have been motivated by the futures expiry on Friday, as well as by investor sentiment primed for a move after the recent consolidation. And maybe, just maybe, it has something to do with mounting excitement over the upcoming Bitcoin halving, expected in just over 2 weeks. Download our recent report on the Bitcoin halving for analysis of its potential impact. In the news, new crypto asset products keep flowing thick and fast, while increasing attention is being paid to enterprise applications including the handling of data in a post-COVID-19 world as well as central bank digital currencies. And DeFi continues its process of growing up. Outside the crypto space, things are getting even weirder as disinfectant manufacturers plead with us not to inject their products, and traders eye their bathtubs and kitchen pots for possible oil storage. Tensions are rising in Europe as Italy, the European Union's third largest economy, has been pity spared a drop to junk bond status. Asian markets are dealing with the suspense over North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's health and the unrelated threat of a second wave of contagion. Markets are reeling between relief things aren't even worse and fear they will be, with a dose of denial thrown in. Bitcoin has outperformed the S&P 500 so far this week, month and year to date, although gold and long-term government bonds have done significantly better so far this year. Next week we'll see a slew of economic indicators that will most likely be shockingly awful, but this week the futures actually went up on the news that more than 4 million people applied for benefits, because it seems confirmation of bad news is somewhat reassuring. You do have to wonder when the penny will drop that indices suspended from reality don't stay afloat forever. On the other hand, some economies are tentatively eyeing a reopening of some sort, which will bring a welcome if tentative respite to restive animal spirits. Chainlink's The Economist magazine dives into the options available to governments trying to figure out how to guide their economies out of this crisis. The options, none of which look good, include following the financial repression policies of the post-war economies of the previous century, which could take the form of capital controls, fixed exchange rates, rationed bank lending and caps on interest rates. It acknowledges such changes would be politically demanding, but that these are politically demanding times. But if governments did enact such changes, it goes on, they would spur responses unavailable to investors of the 1950s and 1960s, such as investment in cryptocurrencies and other immaterial products. Takeaway, exactly. The modern economy has gone through hardship before that required ideological sacrifices, but not at a time when there were alternatives to central bank currencies, and not at a time when it was possible to move wealth without using the established system. Does that make governments weaker at the expense of empowered citizens? Or could the governments use cryptocurrencies to become empowered themselves? I've mentioned in this newsletter before that I worry about a sustained uptick in inflation once we have emerged from the worst of this crisis, and how that could be good for Bitcoin's value given its limited supply. But what if I am wrong and we enter a world of deflation? Does that mean Bitcoin will underperform? Not necessarily. The resulting boost in its purchasing power and its parallels to gold, which has traditionally done well in times of deflation, could give it fuel to outperform. Takeaway: Bitcoin was born during the last financial crisis, so its reactions and correlations have not been tested. We do not know under which scenario it will perform best, and economic theory can justify swings either way. Crypto asset platform Coinbase describes the current stablecoin landscape, with a focus on use cases. Takeaway: the power of stablecoins to encourage liquidity, facilitate transactions and act as collateral is just beginning to be understood. The growth this year is likely to continue to be staggering, driven largely by both transaction demand and a surging global demand for dollars, of which stablecoins are a relatively convenient and liquid representation. For more on this topic, see Michael Casey's newsletter, Money Reimagined, from last week. A research paper funded by University of California Berkeley's Haas Blockchain Initiative concludes stablecoin issuances do not push up the price of cryptocurrencies. Takeaway: this contradicts a controversial paper from last year that aimed to prove Tether manipulated the Bitcoin market. The new paper separates Tether in circulation from Tether held in Treasury, and shows the stablecoin's premium to the dollar depends largely on the market volatility. More nuance on last week's news that Renaissance Technologies has submitted regulatory filings showing its flagship fund Medallion can invest in Bitcoin derivatives. As we hinted last week, it's not as bullish as the media initially painted it. Takeaway: my colleague Ian Allison asked several industry insiders for their take on the news. All agree Renaissance is not necessarily going long Bitcoin. The story and the potential are not what drives their decisions, those are based on algorithmically generated numbers. Starbucks and McDonald's are reportedly among 19 restaurants and retail shops that will be involved in testing China's central bank digital currency in the country's Xiong'an New District. Takeaway: why is this potentially relevant for portfolios? Because mandated change is usually more powerful in overcoming resistance to new habits than the pull of innovation on its own. A national digital currency would get people comfortable with the idea of digital wallets, for instance, and from there it's a relatively short step to incorporating other tokens and services. This is potentially significant because of its indirect relevance to the adoption of crypto assets in one of the largest economies, in which almost 1 billion people have a smartphone. Wolfie Zhao walks us through changes to the Bitcoin mining industry in China over the past year, going into the impact of the coronavirus, how the March crash shifted sentiment, and the outlook for the new machines hitting the market. Takeaway: as we talked about in our halving report, the Bitcoin mining industry is not only fascinating, it's fundamental for the health of the network. Shifts in technology, economic conditions and political environment determine profitability, which in turn impacts the protocol's resilience. For more on this intriguing sector, at the intersection between business priorities, technological innovation and ideology, check out Christine Kim's podcast series on miner economics. The CFTC has given crypto startup Bitnomial Exchange approval to offer physically settled futures and options contracts. Takeaway: not that long ago a lot of us got excited about the pending launch of physically delivered derivatives on Bakkt, which ended up having a disappointing launch and an even more disappointing trading record. Bitnomial's fee and margin structure might end up being more attractive to investors and traders, but, unlike Bakkt, for now it lacks the blue-chip backing of a market incumbent. Crypto asset and blockchain data provider AmberData lays out a detailed explanation of the stock-to-flow S2F model that predicts a Bitcoin price of $100,000 by the middle of 2021. Takeaway, the S2F model has adherents and skeptics. It seems to hold historically, but that's not generally a good basis for forward investing, especially in these strange times. Check out our halving report for a look at some competing theses. The bottom line is the Bitcoin market is so different now than during the previous halvings that no one knows what features or developments will carry more weight in price impact. Vishal Shah, founder of Bitcoin derivatives exchange Alpha 5, points out that, with 100x leverage available on some exchanges with relatively light oversight, Bitcoin won't interest traditional capital, especially in these uncertain times. Takeaway, it's unlikely that 100x leverage is actually used by most traders, however the few brave souls that do so are likely to get wiped out pretty soon, leaving the more sensible traders who push the boat out to maybe 35x, if that. 100x leverage is more a worrisome marketing gimmick than a wealth accumulation strategy. Security token platform Open Finance has asked its users for revised terms to defray costs in a bid to avoid having to suspend trading. Takeaway, after intensifying in 2018, interest in security tokens has been muted over the past year or so because investor demand failed to materialize and contract frictions set back some high-profile projects. This development is an extension of the damped enthusiasm but should not be taken to mean that the concept has no merit. It's early, the advantages so far have not been enough to overcome inertia and the fact that traditional markets are more liquid and have greater regulatory assurances. Given the recent market stress exposing a range of fault lines, though, we might once things start to settle down a bit start to see a renewed interest in an alternative capital market system. This concludes our edition for today. We want to thank again Paycademy, the first business school to learn payments and fintech, for their support. You can find more information on their website at paycademy.com. We hope you enjoyed it and see you tomorrow for our next edition.